On this episode of The Prediction Trade, former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci returns to share why he's bullish on Bitcoin, his 2021 price target, his predictions on the New York City mayoral race, and his bombshell forecast on the fate of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
All you false pretenders and you freaky contenders, trying to be the first. In my own opinion, you am not defending. You are the worst.
Welcome back to The Prediction Trade. I'm Jeff Joseph, editorial director of Luckbox Magazine. I'm joined by Mike Reddy, the producer of the show, also an editor at Luckbox Magazine. Mike, how are you?
Good, Jeff. Did you happen to watch The Masters at all?
I had reasons to watch The Masters. We had Paul Krishnamurti in our prior episode take us to school on a master class on betting The Masters. I took it to heart and took his field to heart and entered my first golf wagers ever. I can say I've never wagered on golf before, but finally got around to it. Thank God I had him behind me. You know, there's something compelling about golf wagering, particularly now that they've added real-time wagering. You can do live betting that more or less between the rounds, the four rounds of the Masters. You can bet between rounds. You can even bet in the middle of the rounds for outcomes on any particular round and altogether. So there's a lot of optionality. It's really good for active gamblers and wagers and investors who like the options of having a field of bets out there. I would have been lost without it, but I basically stuck to his list. I placed about 11 wagers. Only three of them came in, but because of the odds on field bets, on the each way bets, where you pick the top 10 winners or names that end up in the top 10, those three bets out of 11 allowed me to be profitable. So I had a net winnings on the Masters as a result of Corey Connors, Cameron Smith, and Tony Finau, who came in 8th, 9th, and 10th, respectively. Paul picked them as each way bets. What was more interesting, Mike, what I'd add to it is just how compelling the payoffs are, having not really paid attention to this in the past. Hideki Matsuyama, who won the Masters, was a true long shot. He was 40-1 at the outset. And Will Zalatoris, who came in second, only one stroke behind, a rookie, his first Masters performance ever at 9 under par, he was 66-1 coming out before the first tee. So high payoffs. And if you play the field and play each way bets, you pick up about 1/5 of those per the master class that Paul shared with us. And you can see how betting a variety of players going into a tournament like this can be a bet that offers a lot of hedges and lots of opportunities for payouts.
Pretty disappointing performance from JT out there. Justin Thomas did not live up to the expectation that a lot of the betting sites were putting him up to.
Well, no, this was all about the long shots. The short list of favorites just did not show up. You could say the same for DJ. You can say for DeChambeau as well. You know, some of the players that were under 10-1 going in did not show up on the leaderboard in the top 10. But it was a great learning experience. We're going to have Paul back on again, probably in front of another PGA Tour coming up.
Or cricket or snooker, his other two favorite sports to bet on there.
Well, I think we have a lot to learn about snooker and cricket, so that's not a bad idea. But all right, well, Mike, let's introduce today's guest, former White House Director of Communications and founder of the investment management company SkyBridge. Anthony Scaramucci is back once again to return to the show. Anthony first joined us in March of 2020. That was our last episode that we recorded before the COVID lockdowns. And Anthony, well, welcome to the show, Anthony. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great. We got the Joe Biden stuff right. I went back and listened to some of that. We got the, he got the nomination and he went on to become president despite the the Fox News natterings, Jeff. He was well in the lead. I mean, it was a closer race than people think, actually, because of the Electoral College. But we got a lot of that stuff right, thank God.
It's true. And Mike is always, he's always a devil for the detail on that. So he went back and took a look at some of the specific recommendations you made, and you were pretty impressive. We covered a lot of markets in that episode. And one of them was you called clemency for Roger Stone. You said that was a strong likelihood. It was 57 cents at the time. So that paid a buck. So close to 100% return. Netanyahu, that he would be prime minister of Israel as of the end of the year. And of course he was. That was 56 cents at the time. So again, another 90% plus return. There were some easier ones that you said Pence will definitely be the 2020 GOP VP nominee. Of course, that was back in March where there was some question about that, but it was trading at 78 cents at the time. And probably one of the more difficult ones that you nailed was Biden winning Wisconsin. That was 60 cents at the time. You had a high conviction trade there, and certainly that came in as well. So you did pretty well.
Well, I mean, I shouldn't have come back then, Jeffrey. I can only go downhill from here, you know? I mean, but I'm ready to lock and load. A lot about your questions. I'm ready to lock and load. Let's fire away.
We'll do it. Do you look at these predicted markets frequently? Are you checking them out every once in a while?
I do, because I think that it's to your point in some of our intellectual conversations about this stuff. There's wisdom in the crowds. Certainly, in my mind, there's wisdom when people are putting money into situations, and so I sort of believe that. That collective wisdom is borne out a lot of the times in predicted markets. And sometimes predicted markets get things wrong, but by and large, they've got a general tendency to see things the way that they are coming or the way that they are.
Well, they certainly did a good job in the last general election. And even in Georgia and the subsequent Senate races, the prediction markets identified a closer race than the polling markets were. Once again, I think the prediction markets had a discernible edge over 538's outcomes, and that was generally acknowledged. You know, polling had a tough year in 2020 compared to the prediction markets. So that continues to be a good ongoing debate about the accuracy and relevance of polling versus the prediction markets. And we look at it the same way you do. It's just another tool. It's another tool of sentiment that can't be ignored. And there are systemic issues with respect to polling that get in the way of accurate results. And I think once again, we had an opportunity to witness that.
Yeah, no question. And if you like politics, I'll recommend John Allen's new book called Lucky, which is about the Biden-Trump 2020 campaign and the eventual election and the presidency. Some great stories in there, some great intrigue. We're talking about Wisconsin, what happened up in Wisconsin. Remember, President Trump only lost that election by 43,000 votes. If you tabulated Wisconsin, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, the three states that
80,000, right?
Yeah. And then obviously, if you add in Arizona, but you know, the point being is he won the popular vote in the coastal parts of the country. But, you know, that's not how that election is run. That election is run through the Electoral College. And so it's going to be another close 2024, no matter who the candidates are, it'll be close again.
And your view on the Electoral College, it's something we've never talked about. I'm curious what your feelings are.
So I'm a fan of the Electoral College. The only thing I don't like is what the Republicans have done with what I call the tyranny of the minority. And so just give me 30 seconds on this. If you step back and look at the construction of the documents, it was important for Madison and Hamilton, Franklin and others to make sure that we didn't have mob rule or rule in the country by popular vote. Because what happens is minorities, and I don't mean black and brown people or Hispanic people, I mean the minority representation isn't fairly represented. And that's the reason why Rhode Island has two senators, but so does the state of California. And so the notion that the Electoral College would keep things honest from that perspective. Now, some people argue that it was racially charged and all this other stuff. I don't I don't see it that way. And if you really look at Cicero's writings going back 2,200 years to the Roman Republic, which they were basing these things on, there's a great book written recently called First Principles. I'll get you the author in a second, but just talking about the construction of the document. So for me, I'm a big fan of the Electoral College. What the Republicans have done is they've subverted this. They did something about 25 years ago called Operation Red Map. And what was that? They started flooding the state legislatures with tremendous amounts of money in an effort to control the state legislatures, which then have a say about gerrymandering. And they've done a reasonably good job despite having lower voter registration numbers than independents and Democrats of winning elections and still holding power. As an example, the Republicans have only won the popular vote for the U.S. presidency one time in the last seven elections. That was in 2004 when George W. Bush beat John Kerry. But in general, I am in favor of it. I think it would be a disaster. And you can study history in understanding this. If the minority does not have a fair representation and a hard enough check on the mob, if you will, it usually leads to a governmental disaster. So I am in favor of it.
Well, speaking of structural changes, then what about the Supreme Court? Now, just last week, Biden announced that he would form the commission that he spoke to during the course of the campaign that would reexamine the current balance on the Supreme Court and the amount of justices. You have any thoughts there?
Listen, we can go back to 1937 and the idea of the court being packed by Franklin Roosevelt. He didn't like the configuration of the court and the way they were rejecting some of his New Deal proposals. I think that you've got that mudslinging going on right now. I think there's soreness about Judge Garland not getting to the Supreme Court. And then obviously 8 days prior to the election, they rammed through a Republican candidate for the court. And so I get the rough and tumble nature of all this stuff, but I do think it would be a mistake to upset the balance of the Supreme Court, because once you strike that match, if they've learned in the Senate by reducing the threshold to 50% or 51 votes on matters like this, what you've learned is that you're striking a match and you're going to be setting off bombs that you don't fully anticipate down the road. And so, you know, why couldn't we have 50 people or 51 people on the Supreme Court, Jeff? So to me, I would like them to hold the line where we are now. I get the consternation by the Democrats about the maneuvers, but here's what I would say. I would say elections matter. And you got to dig in and you got to fight for each one of these elections. The Democrats have won this election. It will turn out that Donald Trump's power in the United States won't be fully felt until 20 years from now, Jeff. And that's because take a look at the 400 plus people that he was able to nominate to the federal courtships and go through them and see where those people, many of them young people in their 40s and 50s, they'll be on the court for the next two decades plus. And so his power will be felt then. So it turns out that that was a very consequential election, the 2016 election, because of all of the appointments that were open and available to the Republicans. And of course, Mitch McConnell rammed them through. But I do think it would be a mistake. It would be a procedural disaster for the country. That's my honest opinion of it. And it would set up another rolling snowball of cynicism. And we've got enough snowballs of cynicism right now. We've got avalanches, frankly, of cynicism right now.
Well, the prediction markets seem to share your doubt of that outcome. The question I'm predicted, will there be more than 9 Supreme Court justices at any point in 2021, is a 95-cent no. So if you're betting yes that there'll be more justices added, there's 20-to-1 payoff there, but the market doesn't believe there's a high probability there.
Yeah, I think the market's going to be right about that. So, you know, I like those ones that are trading in the 50s, where we have to take a big guess, Jeff.
Well, that's where you did well last time. We're going to get into the markets. We really wanted to have you on to talk about the New York markets. A couple of weeks ago, we had James Altucher on, fellow New Yorker. Yep. And you probably recall his New York is Dead op-ed that appeared first on LinkedIn, then it ended up on the New York Post. And of course, Jerry Seinfeld wrote a rebuttal to that that was well published. I understand you were on James Altucher's show as well.
Yeah, listen, I'm friends with James. I have an enormous amount of respect for him. It was very provocative, what he wrote. Some of what he's saying is true. Also, I think Jerry Seinfeld's rebuttal was clever and thoughtful. But I think that at the end of the day, let's talk about the truth in James Altucher's writings. You can reach a tipping point in a city. That would be Newark in the 60s, Detroit in the mid to late 60s. You can pick certain cities where the inner city, the inside urban area, is effectively destroyed. And so you have it, it's rife with crime, it's rife with drug addiction, it's rife with homeless people, and it forces the population of people that don't want to act in that way outside of the inner city. And then you've got other issues. Now, you know, you could make it political and you could say, well, go look through the cities that are not doing well, San Francisco, et cetera. These are by and large left-leaning cities. Why are these left-leaning cities not doing well? And ultimately, it comes down to three categories. Category number one is a safety net. You have to have a safety net for the indigent. Category number two, you need the right type of policing. Obviously, stop and frisk is a very unpopular type of policing, but you could have disciplined policing. It doesn't include that racial charge, if you will. And then the third category is that you have to have a city that is open for business. Just think of Mayor Suarez down in Miami. Mayor Suarez is a Republican, but he has zero tolerance for the homeless situation. He's spending a tremendous amount of money. Right now, I spoke to him 2 weeks ago. At the time of our speaking, he had 550 homeless people in the city of Miami, and he's working it down to zero. But you know, so the point being, if you can get those three things right in a city will run well. You'll see population growth in the city. Mayor Bloomberg, 12 years running New York City, had population growth, had those things in check. He's by and large a liberal. But you have to run the city with some level of business practicality. And I think what James is basically saying, we don't have that in our city anymore. And so we've had 8 years of rank incompetence, 8 years of very hard to explain policies, frankly. You know, I mean, I guess you don't want to collect the trash and you want homeless people on the street defecating in front of the other people. I think Mayor de Blasio has decided he doesn't like rich people. Every couple of weeks, he sends out a tweet, tax the rich. I don't really understand what he's doing or why he's doing that. It seems discriminatory. This is the ultra-left progressive. Some rich people didn't choose their riches, Jeff, as you know. Other people, you know, I don't understand why he has to be casting aspersions at people that are rich. A lot of rich people, frankly, have their money invested in their businesses and are creating jobs in the society and creating cultural ecosystems that are beneficial to great cities. So to me, you've got a complete imbecile running New York. And if you get another complete imbecile, then James Altucher part two essay will be, well, I was right and here are the reasons why. But, you know, I'm hoping that Jerry Seinfeld will be right. We won't get a complete imbecile in New York City. We'll get somebody that's more practical. Again, it's a liberal city. You can run a liberal city but successfully, but you need some common sense in the orientation of the execution of those three things that I laid out.
Well, we're going to get right to your thoughts about who stands to come out the next mayor of New York City, as well as a look at Governor Cuomo's current political woes. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Want a little more luck in your life? Get Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Named Best New Magazine of 2019 and 2020, Luckbox is the must-read magazine of active investors, big thinkers, side hustlers, entrepreneurs, gamblers, data geeks, and risk takers. You can buy Luckbox on newsstands, but with this special offer, receive a 10-issue digital subscription absolutely free. Visit getluckbox.com/TPT to receive the award-winning Luckbox in your inbox. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox. Learn more at getluckbox.com/TPT.
We're back with Anthony Scaramucci of SkyBridge Capital, former communications director under the Trump administration for those 11 days that are now known as a mooch. What's that unit of measure?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a mooch or a Scaramucci.
A Scaramucci?
I mean, it's one more day. It's 11 days. There are 10 letters in my last name, Jeff. So there's some symmetry there. But listen, you know what? I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. It was a harrowing experience for me, and I'll tell all of your listeners, if you're having a bad day, I want you to imagine me on the 31st of July in 2017. My wife had filed for divorce. I'm blown from the White House into Pennsylvania Avenue, and I'm rolled in margarita salt after I've been skinned by the late-night comedians, including Saturday Night Live. So if you're having a bad day, put it in perspective. Of course, I was able to figure out a way to get my marriage back together, and I went back to SkyBridge, and we're back in the process of growing SkyBridge. And, and I think I was helpful in defeating Donald Trump. So, I mean, I don't know if I was helpful or not, but at least I was out there advocating the case for why he was a disastrous president and why we needed to find somebody different, anybody but him. This Evian bottle that I'm staring at right now would have been a better president than him. And so I'm very happy that we were able to get him out of there.
Well, amidst all that, you made some pretty strong market calls. I know that SkyBridge made a big move into Bitcoin. When did you initially make that move into Bitcoin?
So I want to give some context, if it's okay. I had the Winklevosses at the SALT conference in 2014.
Certainly.
They started buying Bitcoin in 2012. They were with me in the green room explaining to me why I needed to own Bitcoin. I told them that I'm an institutionalist, that I run money for institutions and individuals that are scaled like institutions. My nickname for them are Instavisuals. You know, they've got the scale and size of an institution, but they make decisions like an individual. And I told those guys that I couldn't get involved with this thing unless I was confident that it was robustly and fully scaling, pursuant to Metcalfe's law. And so I came up with an arbitrary number. Frankly, I wish that number was lower because I would have bought it earlier. But I said, if this can get to 100 million users, it will scale to a billion. And so therefore, I need to get involved, get my clients involved. And it sort of got there last July, Jeff. And then the two secondary factors were regulation. I think we're finding that in the Western countries, the regulation has been benign. The taxation has certainly been benign. We tax Bitcoin as an intangible here in the U.S., beneficial tax treatment for individuals. And then the third piece was storage. At the time that we were talking about it, those coins were trading at $400 a coin, but they were very hard to store. And for those that don't know about Bitcoin, there are only 21 million coins that could ever be produced. But because of poor storage in the beginning of Bitcoin's adoption, approximately 3 million of those coins have been lost. And so when you step back and you think about it and you put it into context, if you can't store it properly, you shouldn't own it. Now that Fidelity has a storage facility, one of the largest asset managers in the world, NYDIG, New York Digital Investment Group, has a great cold storage facility. Again, cold storage, you're unclipped from the internet. You've got three or four backup stations, if you will, around the country, all well guarded. It makes sense to start scaling. And so we began that process in October. We started putting Bitcoin in our funds once we got SEC approval in November. And I think we were in there at about $12,000 to $13,000 a coin. We launched our Bitcoin fund. So it's a Bitcoin-only product in December. And we opened it to investors January 4th, first Monday of the year. That fund is up 120% today. We have over $600 million in Bitcoin across our platform. And, you know, listen, I think Bitcoin is going to be a very big part of the future. Fiat currency is being threatened by policy and by the way people are using fiat currency in the world. You know, as an example, the United States adding in the $1.9 trillion stimulus will have produced 40% more U.S. dollars in the last 12 months than what we had over the prior 244 years. So that's dangerous. That's a hidden tax, Jeff, on your savings account. It's a hidden tax on your assets, because if I look at my account, I have $100 in it, and the U.S. government just printed 40% more of those dollars, then my purchasing power on that money has been weakened. And you can see that in asset inflation, whether it's Hamptons real estate, smart real estate up on the lake in Chicago, or great properties around the world, they're all inflating astronomically as a result of these policy decisions.
So your fund is 100% long Bitcoin. You were long from about 12,000. Of course, the price just broke 60,000 again in the last couple of days, pushing towards its high of 62,000. This is probably on the heels of Coinbase coming to market this week. You know, recorded revenue of somewhere around $1.3 billion with a profit of $322 million. It's going to be a hell of an IPO this week. And Coinbase alone has 56 million customers. So your 100 million threshold of customers is easily being achieved in those markets. So we'll bring you back on to talk about cryptocurrencies and the price of Bitcoin in a future episode where we can spend more time on it. But over the short term, are you looking at more upside or some kind of pullback after this coming week?
Well, listen, I think that you know, this is a volatile asset still. I mean, people talk about it as a store of value. I think it will become a store of value, but it has levels of volatility in it. There's no reason why it couldn't trade down 20% from here. I think it'll be unlikely to go down 50 to 80% like it did in 2017, just because you have more global demand for Bitcoin and the macroeconomic factors that are affecting the overall global economy make it demand worthy. I mean, in other words, to own Bitcoin. But, you know, listen, anything can happen. I'm a big believer, having done this for 33 years, less my disastrous 11 days in the White House, I'm a big believer that anything that you think cannot happen will likely happen, and you have to plan for it. But if you're asking me the most likely scenarios, it is Bitcoin is volatile, but it's steady upward. It's asymmetrically volatile to the upside. The demand is just starting. I think one of the reasons why we crossed back over 60,000 is that the legendary investor Daniel Loeb from Third Point made an announcement over the weekend, or at least it was found in one of the filings, that he owns Bitcoin. And I'm not exactly sure how much he owns. I am fully disclosed. I am an investor in his fund for SkyBridge. He's one of my largest positions. But I would imagine if you got a $17 billion fund, then he has a 1% position. He's already got $170 million in Bitcoin. And I just want you to think of the magnitude of investors, hedge fund managers, institutional investors like BlackRock, who are wading into Bitcoin. And with only 18 million coins, let me just put this in perspective. There are 46 million global millionaires, according to JP Morgan's private bank. So if you only have 18 million coins left of Bitcoin, we don't even have enough Bitcoin for each millionaire to own one coin. And so I do think that there will be a supply shortage of Bitcoin, and that scarcity is going to push the price up. And so I've been calling for a $100,000 price target by the end of the year. I think that that's quite likely, just given what I know about the supply-demand fundamentals in Bitcoin.
That's fair. All right, let's move on. We're going to take a quick break, but up ahead, we're going to walk into the political prediction markets at predictit.org. I want to remind listeners that you can wager real money at predictit.org. If you're not already trading on Predictit, we have a promo for you. Put in $20, we'll add $20, and you'll have $40 to start with. So go to predictit.org/promo/TPT20, deposit 20, and you'll have 40 to start trading with. We'll be right back. So we're talking about the New York mayor's race. We know how you feel about de Blasio, but there's a couple markets on the table here in New York. or at predictit.org, specifically is the New York City mayoral election winner. Currently, Andrew Yang's in front at 63 cents. And of course, 63 cents in a binary option is the equivalent of the market saying that there's a 63% probability that he will become the next mayor. Eric Adams is next at 20 cents and Scott Stringer down at 9 cents. How do you call that race?
Okay, so, I mean, I'm not a politically correct person, Jeff, and I've had this conversation with Andrew. For whatever reason, and some of it is attributed to Donald Trump, some of it is attributed, frankly, to the virus itself, there have been a series of Asian hate crimes that have taken place across the country recently. And I think Andrew, whether we like it or not, and clearly he is my favorite, I believe he will be the mayor. Let me start out by saying that. And I am helping Andrew, so I want to disclose that to you. But I do think he's up against that issue. And so I'm worried a little bit about the Tom Bradley effect. And I don't know if you remember Mayor Bradley, but just quickly for your listeners, when they polled on Bradley, are you going to vote for his reelection? People said yes. And then he lost by 7 or 8 points. And then people said, well, why the hell did he lose like that? Well, when people were called and asked about their voting, they didn't want to appear racist. So they said, oh, yes, I'm voting for Mayor Bradley. But they didn't vote for him when they shut the curtain. And so I'm worried a little bit about that for Andrew. I think Andrew is the best of the bunch. The one thing I would worry about from an administrative and an executive function would be the same thing I'd worry about for anybody, myself included, that is a business person that goes into politics. It is a totally different game. It is a totally different set of rules. It is a totally different set of incentives, if you will, than business. And so that lack of experience as a politician, he's a hell of a campaigner. He's got very high favorability. He's got the best name recognition of the group. But remember, he's going to go into the rough and tumble inner city world of New York City politics. And so we have to figure out a way to help him shine if he's successful. Because we need him. We need him desperately. We don't, as much as I love James Altucher, I don't want him to be right about New York City. And so we need somebody that will blunt what's going on with de Blasio. And by the way, I just want to point this out. My feelings about de Blasio, these aren't personal. This is just empirical data of what he's done to destroy the city. I would also point out, if you live in New York, good luck finding somebody that likes this SOB, because whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, I haven't been able to find anybody, even my friends that are AOC fans and are radical lefties, they despise Bill de Blasio because empirically he's failed the city. Empirically, I mean, the fact that our kids in New York City didn't go to school this year is an example of his incompetence and is an example of his callous disregard for human beings. And he's just a rank ideologue. So, and again, that stuff's based on objective criteria. What he's got going for him is the police department of Giuliani and Bloomberg over that 20-year period of time figured out a way to suppress crime and to deliver good crime results. But remember, the first part of his term, you had the police officers turning their backs on de Blasio because of the type of person he is.
Literally turning their backs on.
Turning their back. Yeah. So you're asking me about Andrew Yang. I think the 63 cents is good. My money's there with Andrew Yang. And I predict he'll win the race. But let's not kid ourselves. There is racially charged biases related to Asian Americans right now, which I obviously find distasteful, I disdain, and I find unfortunate. And what I would say to Andrew, and I have said this to him, we got to work 4 times harder because of that potentiality of the quote-unquote Bradley effect.
Let's move over to the governor's market. The market is, will Andrew Cuomo be governor of New York at the end of this year? We obviously know he's been dealing with a lot politically, not only 10 or 11 allegations at this point of sexual misconduct, beginning way back in December of 2020 with Lindsay Boylan, and then most recently on April 7th, and another unnamed aide stepped up. So there's about 10 or 11 women that have come forward accusing him of some sort of sexual misconduct, sexual harassment. 10 of them have named themselves. One is unnamed. Then in addition to that, we have the nursing home scandal with respect to the unrecorded deaths and one of his staff members suggesting that he actually misled on the accounting of those deaths. How do you handicap Cuomo and his ability to stay in office?
So I'm a buyer, and so I would be buying into the trade that he makes it to the end of the year. I've got a little bit longer dated trades for you. These are more controversial. He will be the Democratic nominee for governor, and he will win that race. He will get a fourth term as governor. Now, you've got the nursing home situation, which I think they have to deal with and address. I think he'll come out okay on that, actually, because I have a lot of information related to it. I'm not saying that they handled everything properly. I think one of the problems Andrews had from an optics perspective is he wrote a book about the COVID-19 situation, and people think it was a congratulatory, celebratory book. In fact, it wasn't. If you read the book, which I have, and I interviewed Andrew on our Salt Talk series, the book is a list of mistakes, actually. And the book is, here's everything that we got wrong, including both Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo in the month of February saying that New York was going to be fine and we didn't need to worry about the COVID-19 virus. And of course, despite the ravaging that's taken place in the United States, New York still has the highest per capita death totals, primarily because of the months of March and April of last year. And we can contact trace where the virus came. It was Chinese tourists in northern Italy that created the havoc in Italy, and many northern Italians flying out of Milan and Venice entered the port cities of New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, and that's really where the sort of the super spreader activity happened. And this is before we got our arms around the situation and started to really understand how to protect ourselves from the virus. But I think he's going to come out of this okay. Now, listen, the allegations that are being made about him, I think he has to answer for that. And I think he will answer for that, but I don't think it's going to lead to him being thrown from office. That's my honest opinion.
Well, there's
remember, he hasn't forced himself. You know, if he's done things that are inappropriate, again, you know, I'm going to give everybody the benefit of the doubt for the sake of our conversation. These are allegations, but these women should be heard. And I certainly want safe space for women. So I'm not trying to deny what they're saying. But it's not clear to me that it's crossed over into the ejection zip code at this point.
Well, there's a couple things to unpack there because there's a couple markets on predictit.org that deal with Cuomo. The first one we just mentioned, will Andrew Cuomo be governor of New York at the end of the year? And currently the yes is 65 cents. When James Altucher was on, we asked him the same question. And he said yes for similar reasons, that he'd be able to ride out the storm, ride out the internal investigation, ride out the AG's investigation. At that point, the market was at 47 cents for a yes, that he would be governor by the end of the year. And then a couple of days later, on March 31st, of course, we've had Cuomo sign new recreational cannabis into law with a legalization bill on March 31st. And since then, the market's gone from about 50 to 65 cents. So currently it's 65 cents. You're pretty confident that he will remain governor to the end of the year. That's right?
Yeah, I am. I'm very confident. I would be betting that. And I think that that's an interesting point that you're making through the cannabis situation. I think he is figuring out, because he is a political survivor, he is figuring out a way to appease the radical left or the left of his party to keep himself in office. I would point out that there are Republicans that don't want him impeached. You say, well, why wouldn't the Republicans go after him? The Republicans are afraid that they're going to get somebody way worse than Andrew. Remember, up until right now, we haven't had a tax increase during his tenure. Now, we're likely going to get one because of the debacle known as COVID-19 and the shortfall that we have in the New York State budget. But we haven't had one under his reign. And the Republicans, they dislike Andrew Cuomo, certainly. They would want a Republican governor, certainly. But he's probably the best that they could get on the side of the Democrats. So I don't see the Republicans moving to impeach him, by the way.
I say, well, I think the news that you're really making here is your call on Andrew Cuomo actually to win the Democratic nomination for governor in 2022. That's another market at predicted.org. Currently, Attorney General Letitia James is in front at 41 cents. Andrew Cuomo is next at 26 cents. And then Kathy Hochul behind that. In fact, Andrew Yang's on it at 3 cents. And also at 3 cents is Senator Kristen Gillibrand, junior senator out of New York. That was James Altucher's pick, by the way. Not that she would ultimately win the nomination, that at 3 cents he thought it was very attractive because she was a unannounced candidate and that there might be some chatter going forward about her entering the race and trading up significantly from 3 cents. Any thoughts on that, on Kristen Gillibrand? You think she'd come into the race?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think she's incredibly smart. But I think she's a do-nothing senator. I can't think of anything that she's done for the state of New York. I would say that Chuck Schumer and Senator Gillibrand will be known for their lack of resistance to the salt tax deduction caps, which are borderline criminal for blue states. And basically, I'll just make the case quickly, more money goes into the coffers of the state treasury from places like New York and California than is received from the federal government in terms of outlays. And yet they put this this salt tax deduction in place, which was a David and Charles Koch design to push more power into the red states. The fact that they allowed that to go through without any strong lobbying, and even President Trump said, well, you know, it was on the table to negotiate, but they didn't even come to negotiate it. Okay, so that was reprehensible. And I'm going to say this, you know, the port cities of the United States, and I disagree with when I was talking to President Trump at that time, he asked me about it. I said, it's a stupid thing to do. You think it's beneficial to the Republicans, but it's damaging to the country because those port cities are the portals of immigration and the portals of great economic transformation and innovation for the country. And unfortunately, poor people are also coming through, whether you like it or not. And those cities, whether it's Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, they need safety nets. And you need the apparatus that's put in place by the higher taxes. And so, you know, the grievances here in New York now is that the taxes are not commensurate with the services. But you could not make that case in 2012. You're paying higher taxes, but Mayor Bloomberg was administering the city and you were getting great services. And so today, you're paying higher taxes without the services. So Gillibrand, nice person, smart person. She is flat soda when it comes to campaigning. I think her and her mom voted for her in the presidential primary. I'm not sure anybody else did. And she, remember, she wasn't elected to the senatorship. She was granted that position by then Governor David Patterson to replace Hillary Clinton. Right. And now once she's in place, the Democratic machinery and the 7-2 registration that Democrats have over Republicans have left her in place. But she's a terrible campaigner and ineffective as a senator. So I don't see how she could get anywhere. That market should be at 0.1 cents. I would be short that market at 3 cents. But let's talk about the other people. Letitia James, a very talented person.
At 41 cents.
She's very disciplined. She's extremely thoughtful and very talented. Can she break the stronghold, the 45-year stronghold of Cuomo name recognition in the state of New York?
Well, she has a little bit of control over that because she is her office is running the investigations right now into Cuomo. Obviously, there's a little political conflict there. What do you think about how that might play out? So your leading candidate for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination is running an investigation against the second leading candidate.
Don't underestimate the craftiness of Andrew Cuomo. and don't underestimate that there's likely will be a deal cut. And if you told me that Tish James was the lieutenant governor running alongside of Andrew Cuomo, I don't know if there's a predicted market for that, but if you told me that they made a deal, they brought the peace, she became the lieutenant governor with the understanding that she was going to be the governor of New York upon his departure after his fourth term is over, you know, stranger things have happened in politics. And so that's a deal. If you're looking at the calculus, if you want to join those two forces as opposed to split those two forces, that's a political deal that has a lot of mutual benefits and a lot of incentives to cut. So to me, I don't see them going to war with each other. But you know, listen, I mean, everybody's ambitious. There's a lot of ego in politics. Maybe that happens, but I'm taking the other side of that bet.
All right. So Andrew Cuomo, though, 26 cents is your call to win the nomination.
Yeah, and also to be governor. He'll win the election.
So I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, another Andrew stepped into the race, right? Andrew Giuliani, didn't he, that's Giuliani's son. Does he have any political experience?
Yeah, you know, I, again, you may know this better than me, but from what I've read, I don't think he's formally filed yet.
No, he hasn't. He implied that he would be a Republican candidate for governor.
Yeah, I think he's right now sending out some smoke signals. He's trying to figure out if he can get some galvanization of support. Lee Zeldin, on the other hand, has thrown his hat in the ring. That's a representative of the island. He's popular with the Trumpers. You know, and again, no offense to these guys. I know both of them personally. I like them, despite my disagreement with them ideologically, intellectually, and as a human being. They like Donald Trump. I think the guy is a jackass. I don't think they have a shot. And they don't have a shot for a number of different reasons, but the main one is the tie to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is hated in the city of New York and the state of New York. Even Republicans that are quasi-normal Republicans or used to be Republicans despise him. So he's got 20% support by what I would call the white Christian nationalist or the Republican fascist division, if you will. But I don't think he has any support from anybody that's normal or practical. So those guys being so closely tied to him is a recipe for disaster. They are the Thelma and Louise of gubernatorial politics. They're going right over the cliff, and there's no shot for them. So I would be short them in those markets.
Do you see any Republican candidate for governor that's not so closely tied to Trump as having any chance of turning that state red?
Well, you would need a Charlie Baker-like personality, right? Charlie Baker, the Republican governor, very successful governor in a very blue state of Massachusetts, doing a good job. Moderate guy, very practical. State is actually growing and doing quite well. And I think it's also an interesting case study in the need for a mixed government. I think one of the problems that New York is having is that it's a one-party state. And what we know about one-party situations is they don't last, and they create tremendous amounts of corruption and tremendous amounts of indifference towards the public. And that could be the one-party state of the Soviet Union, the one-party state of communist China. I mean, you could pick the different places. I mean, one-party states, if you will, have a tendency to have a life expectancy of about 70 years. So we're about 50 years into this thing. We got 20 more years to go in New York. But yeah, no, if you had somebody like a Charlie Baker that would run, you'd have a shot. But I don't think you can go up against the machinery of Andrew Cuomo and his name in the state. And by the way, despite the allegations, and again, I'm not trying to not take them seriously. You have to take them seriously. Even if you take them at the most serious, are these allegations where he has created a criminal offense? I don't know. I don't know what the laws are in the state anymore, but putting your arm on somebody, is it a criminal offense at this point in our country? I don't know. But if it isn't, he's going to survive it.
Well, speaking of putting your arm on somebody, there's one more last market we'll try to sneak in with you, and that is Matt Gaetz has shown up on the political markets to predict it. And the question is, will Matt Gaetz sit on the House Judiciary Committee on September 1st? He's trading at 27 cents for a 27 cents for a yes right now.
So I would be short that market. I think he's about to get blown to smithereens. You have to remember he's a buffoon, and you have to remember he doesn't really have core support. You know, he's not Liz Cheney. He's not Kevin McCarthy. He's a buffoon that overly tied himself to Donald Trump. And what you have to remember about Donald Trump is there was a scene in like the last season of The Sopranos where they ran over some guy's head and squashed it like a cantaloupe in the service station. And then one of the guys turned to the other guy and said, you know, just back up over him. We got to make sure that he's completely dead. And of course, they did that. That's what the Republicans are about to do to Matt Gaetz, metaphorically. He's got no shot to survive. And you have to remember something about Donald Trump. He'll hit you with a bus. Forget about a car at a service station. He'll hit you with a Greyhound bus and then reverse and run it over you. Once he's done using you, that's exactly what he does. So I see the guys having no shot. So who's ever in that market at 27 cents is going to lose their money.
So the question is, will Matt Gaetz sit on the House Judiciary Committee on September 1? He would be buying the nose at 72 cents.
Correct.
Well, Anthony, it's always good to have you on. I know you're
always a lot of fun for me, Jeff. I appreciate it. Congratulations on everything you're doing with the magazine and with the predicted markets. It's awesome.
Well, thank you. I know you're a fan of Luckbox Magazine, and we look forward to doing something with you in an upcoming issue on cryptocurrencies. You're also really busy with a new project. It's called Mooch FM. Can you take a minute and explain that to us?
Yeah, you know, I'm interviewing a whole collection of different people, from authors to scientists to policy makers and leaders, governmental people. It's a lot like the SALT conference in some ways. I'm just finding interesting people who have interesting lives and getting them to share their perspective with our listeners. The podcast was launched about 20 weeks ago, or we're getting about 150,000 downloads a week, which has been fun for me to watch it grow. And, you know, the good news is you're going to be on that podcast very shortly. That's the good news for me.
I'm looking forward to it. That's wonderful. Of course, you're at Scaramucci on Twitter, and you should follow Anthony. He's pretty active and pretty vibrant, to say the least. Thank you so much, Anthony. I look forward to having you back on soon.
God bless. I appreciate it, Jeff.
All right. Thanks much. Bye-bye.
Well, Jeff, it's certainly always great to have Anthony on, but where do we go from here?
Well, we're going up to Canada, Mike. We've already visited Belarus this year, and now there's reasons to go up to Canada. One of the trades on Predicted is about federal elections to occur in 2021, whether or not they will occur. And the Trudeau Liberals in Canada want to move from a minority rule to a majority rule position. And the government's going to present its first ever budget on the 19th of April. That's the first time in 2.5 years for this current parliament. So that budget is expected to create quite a buzz and provoke a federal general election. The question is going to be, does the country wait out the pandemic, or do they have an election this year? Tasha Carradine, who is a well-known political analyst and a writer for the National Post, is going to be here to sort it all out for us. So looks like we're going to go up to school in Canada this time. After that, and ahead of the 147th running of the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May, May 1st, the prediction trade will also host two of the nation's top horse race handicappers. They're going to share their best bets on the 20-horse field of three-year-old thoroughbreds. So we're going to learn a little bit about horse racing and a little bit about Canada, and a lot to come up soon. So that's where we go from here, Mike. That's all we have for this episode of The Prediction Trade. And if you like what you've heard, tell your friends about us and make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out thepredictiontrade.com to sign up for our newsletter, find us on social media, or just to send us a message. And you can also find The Prediction Trade in print in every issue of Luckbox magazine. Go to getluckbox.com/TPT to read the latest issue of Luckbox digitally for free. So thank you again for joining us. This is Jeff Joseph.
And I'm Mike Reddy.
And remember to always wager responsibly, believe in math, master your trade, and join us next time on The Prediction Trade.